Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and my co-pilot and navigator, Mr. Dave Vitti.
Hello, mate.
How are you? You all right?
Very good. Now, Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save your money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. So, Dave, what's been going on, mate?
Oh, you know, this and that. Looking forward to some better weather and getting some sunshine and whatnot. But you're looking well today, Jason. You look like you've had a shave since I last saw you.
Mate, I've had quite a lot of trimmage going on, actually.
Yeah.
Decided I looked... Well, actually, it was my girl said, Dad, Christmas is months away. And do you know what? There was a similarity. So off came the beard. And then when the beard came off, I looked like a... 60s, 70s throwback with long hair, so that had to go as well.
I was wondering whether it was to do with you starting racing again this year, and I thought maybe in the same way that cyclists shave their legs, and also I thought maybe it might shed a few pounds and whatnot, you actually get rid of the hair and you're a sort of more streamlined proposition to actually be racing in the BTCC.
Mate, I must be very frank and honest, there was a tinge of that, and that was I jumped out of a car on a test and just managed to catch sight of myself in in the side window as I was pulling my helmet off with wet hair, and I looked utterly ridiculous. So it had to go.
Hey, talking of racing drivers, we have somebody who knows a thing or two about cars and going fast around corners, don't we, today,
mate? We do. Our guest today, well, he's a gentleman who knows a thing or two about cars. He's an esteemed motoring journalist. He's a pretty good racing driver as well. And he's also host of Top Gear, no less. It's the one and only Mr. Chris Harris.
Welcome.
Hello, all. How are we? Nice to hear from you both.
Mate, you were a bit slow coming in there, weren't you?
I was waiting for you to ramp up the introduction. You went from gentleman. I wanted... global philosopher, prince. I was waiting for more and more compliments to come, but then there was just this silence.
We just had to cut back on the thing, because the thing is, we don't want to overcook you and then make you too sort of big-headed when you come in. We've just got to sort of get you set to a certain level, and then you're in our club.
And then we'll have a dig.
Exactly.
So tell me, mate, Chris.
Yeah.
Was your nickname because you were never seen, or was it because a purveyor of dubious goods?
Well, I think, first of all, your origins are absolutely correct. It comes from arguably the greatest situation comedy ever made in the BBC. And that character, called Monkey Harris, from Only Fools and Horses, was where it came from. But, of course, it's become a bit more problematic now because I work at the BBC, which is a very sensitive organisation, and they've now got someone that presents one of their shows that is small and brown and is called Monkey, and it doesn't go down well. But the fact is, it's unfortunate because it's got nothing to do with me being potentially simian-looking. It's genuinely a heartfelt reference to a brilliant piece of BBC history.
Yeah.
Top Gear, for me, it's really, really found its feet now with the three of you on there. I think the lineup is fantastic. I was going to say to you, my first question to you is Freddie Flintoff as dangerous to be around as we all think he is?
Potentially, yes. I mean, he's got that glint in his eye that makes you realise in any situation, frankly, anything could happen. You know, he's a lovely, lovely man. I adore him. He's just so much fun to be around, but you never quite know. And I think anyone that's ever probably played any professional sport with him or hung out with him always knows that if you do the sort of Terminator-style assessment of any situation and the red letters are going across your visor vision,
yeah,
with Fred, what he's saying is, beware. But the fact is, and this is what's great for Top Gear, 99.9% of what he might do makes for great content. And the first shoot I ever did with the two of them was down at Dunsfold, and we were messing about in some estate cars. I don't know what it was. And he hit me over the head with a watermelon. And the force with which he hit, he had half a watermelon, which he had in one hand. That tells you all you need to know. I'd need four of my hands to hold half a watermelon. And it was cold, this thing. And he squashed it and smashed it over my head. It went into the film. But the force with which he hit me nearly knocked me out. I then realised what a unit he was. I don't know anyone else that lies about their height in the other way. He tells people he's 6'4". If he stands next to someone who's 6'4", they look like they're 5'2". he's massive. But I'm a cricket tragic, dude, and I love the game. So working with him is a bit weird because he'll always be my cricketing hero. 2005 Ashes series is my favourite sporting moment of them all.
Yeah.
So to actually work with him is ridiculous. But I love the fact that he, when he walks into a room, he has that charisma. It's not just the size of the bloke. He has the charisma. But as you've pointed out, there's this sense that anything could happen.
For you, it must be doubly weird and pinch yourself moment because, as you say, to have had Freddie Flintoff as a hero, but also even though you've come through and you've had a very successful career as a journalist and as a racing driver, did you ever honestly think that you would be one of three people presenting Top Gear?
No, never. I mean, look, Jason and I are... Our journey through television success and failure, more failure for me than for him, has been quite closely matched. I mean, I went for the driven job, or rather, my colleagues at Autocar thought it'd be funny when I was drunk one time to apply for me to do the driven job, whenever that was. And I did the screen test, and I was told that it got down to a few of us, and it was me, Jason, and a couple of others, and he got it, and I didn't.
Mate, I'll tell you who it was me, you, and Richard Hammond.
Was it?
Yes. Yeah, and I'll be honest, I was generally the worst of all in terms of my abilities on camera because I've never done it before. But I was good mates with Brewer and Penny, Mallory. So I managed to go via the back door and got them lobbying for me. But in theory, it should have been you or Hammond.
That's amazing how you find this stuff out. But so I've never wanted to be on television, and I've spoken about this. I didn't really at the time. I'm not sure I wanted the job on Top Gear at all. I mean, I was in the doldrums at that point. I'd struggled with YouTube, and when you've got this massive audience and you can't make any money out of it, what people don't realise is you don't do this stuff just because you love it. You've got to earn a crust. Yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't matter if a million people say that your videos are great. It doesn't make any difference. But I think I've always had this, and I'm sure Jason's had this as well. I keep referring back to the 17-year-old me. If the 17-year-old me had been told he had the chance to present Top Gear, it's not possible to say no, regardless of however many red flags may have been raised. And I believe you me, you know, I was writing stuff in the media saying, whoever takes this job is an idiot. It came back to haunt me.
Did you really say that?
Yeah, I did. I wrote a piece on Jalopnik saying, whoever takes this on is a moron. And 3 months later, I took it on.
Do you think, Chris, though, that funnily enough, though, where you are now is a situation that you nor the Top Gear producers knew was going to happen, i.e. you got brought into a different incarnation in terms of the lineup of the show. Your role was very different. Obviously, the presenting fronts were very different. And then through one thing and another, accidentally happened upon a three-presenter pairing that just works.
I think that's the way TV works, doesn't it? And actually so many other things in life. If you spend a load of time trying to define something and you use common sense and some kind of formula, you'll probably end up with something that's a bit inert and insipid. But if you just go with the flow and see what happens and the process of osmosis takes over, you'll probably end up with something quite funky.
Yeah.
And the other thing that has to be said is that the reason why it works for me is I like being the small man in the room. So whoever I'm with, I'll never be the big dog. I'll always be the one. You know, when I travel with Paddy and Fred, most people think I'm carrying their bags. Most people don't know who I am, and they think I'm carrying the bags. And you have to be very comfortable with that to be in my position, and I really am. I always have been. I don't want to be the big dog at all. And, you know, you try working with Matt LeBlanc, he's quite famous. You know, he's about as well known as God. And if you're not comfortable playing second fiddle in understanding the hierarchy of life and where you actually sit in that list of people, then you wouldn't be able to do what I do, I don't think.
Well, it's a bit like self-deprecating humour, isn't it? You know, if it's done right, it's always a great thing.
It is. And I suppose, I don't know, maybe I get it wrong. The difficulty with having your head down and being short and not liking being noticed is that people mistake that for you being arrogant and rude.
I can't believe anyone's thought that of you. That's ridiculous.
but that's what I say to people is, I'm not ignoring you. I'm arrogant and rude in a different way. That's just me. The reason I'm ignoring you is I'm shy. But if you were to talk to me, then you'd find me arrogant and rude.
Arrogant and rude hasn't even arrived yet.
Hey, so talking of Top Gear, Chris, you filming at the minute?
Yeah, we just did. We've just been up in Northumberland in some caravans, which was interesting.
Any humour to be had in that little trip to Northumberland?
Yeah, I mean, I got wedged quite publicly. Actually, not by Andrew this time, but by the other one, with the pointy ears. So McGuinness.
A wedgie, did you say?
Yeah, as in the kind of thing you haven't had done to you since you were 12.
Yeah.
So I was trying to unhitch a trailer, and obviously I'm carrying a bit of timber because it's, you know, been a year of, well, I'm fat anyway. And I'm leaning over this thing, sweating, because the flipping jockey wheel won't go down properly. So helpfully, he decides to lift me up by my pants.
Nice.
And then they separated. The elastic belt separated from the rest of the garment. He then took a photo of that, put it online, but he put it up in a resting state. So actually, it didn't look like I'd had a wedgie at all. It just looked like my pants had just come apart.
Blown apart.
To his however million followers just going, pray for Harris, buy him some more underwear. And the only place in the town that had any Grundies was this old shop. So I bought a pair of Y-fronts. Now, lads, let's get onto the Y-front, because we laugh at them. Your dad used to wear them,
yep. But
they are the business. I wore them for a day, and once I got over the embarrassment, I suddenly thought, there's a reason why people wore these. They're brilliant. They're anatomically correct. All of us that think we can wear Calvin Klein's, you can't. You're past it. You're too old. They're a high-belted brief. They sit correctly on the more corpulent man's stomach, so the relationship between gut and belt is correct. I think the gusset is just superior. It's just because there's more support around the knacker area.
Yeah.
The whole thing, put it this way, if you said to Gordon Murray, design the best pair of pants ever.
Do you think that's what he come up with?
He'd come up with a Y-front.
Do you think so?
He'd tell you there was a reason why. He'd talk about tread block shuffle and slip angle and something about, he'd probably use the word wind tunnel, but ultimately it looked like a jockey Y-front.
Before we get on to current cars, Chris, I want to go back in time a little bit and talk some car history. So the one thing that I never realised actually until this last series of Top Gear, it was one of the latter episodes, and it was the one all about dad cars, which I found very nostalgic, because dad cars for me were Cortinas and Cavaliers, but particularly Cortinas were a big favourite of my dad's. And I saw you there in, I think, was it a 323i?
Yeah, E321, yeah.
Which then took you back to your childhood. But I never realised that actually your motorsport heritage and your motoring genes was passed down through your mum's side.
Yeah, so my old dear was a sort of autocrosser, amateur rally driver in the late 50s. Yeah, she was pretty handy as well. And it was, you know, people forget that back then there were quite a few women in motorsport, quite a few people who did that. And of course, pre-war, look at Brooklands. I mean, that story of the women at Brooklands is fascinating, isn't it? Because everyone's thinking, I know there's a big push to get women into motorsport. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, likewise.
But it was the 70s and 80s that actually stopped women being in motorsport. Before that, a lot more people competed. Mm. So I used to love being in the car, my old dear. She sadly passed away a couple of years ago, but she was great fun until the very end. She always had stupid cars. And one thing I'm just sort of, you know, this probate business during lockdown has been a bit of a nightmare, frankly. Yeah. But I just managed to get everything sorted out. And I've got her old car sitting outside this house here at the moment. And it's an S4 Audi, which I bought for her when she was on her 80th birthday. I bought her an S4. She always liked a fast car.
Fun.
And I remember phoning up the insurance company. Sadly, it wasn't Adrian Flux. It should have been, because they used to sort me out when I was a teenager. But I had a deal with someone else. And they said, yeah, we put it into the computer and it just goes red. There's no one. The actuarial system doesn't allow for an 80-year-old to be 80-year-old woman to be insured on an Audi S4. There's no precedent. So we just need to make a price up for you, which I paid, which was horrendous. But then I had it tuned and chipped, so it's got 400 horsepower, and it sits out there at the moment. I love the idea. Mm. There's nothing makes me smile more than being burnt up by an old woman on the road. Sometimes I just love it. I want to stop. So many men resent it, but I want to stop and ask their story. I want to say, why are you? There's always one, isn't there? You just see some fantastic, glamorous old bird come screaming past you in an unusual car. And I want to stop and say, tell me how you got to that place.
Yeah, do you know what, mate? I would love that.
So, you know, that was my background. It was an interesting film, that. It really did resonate with people. It was a clever piece of TV. It makes you realise, it also reminds you that so much of the relationship you build with your family, if you're a child of the 80s, happened in a motor car. That was the time when no one could escape. You couldn't go to another room in the house. You couldn't do whatever. You were stuck together for journeys.
No phones, no nothing. You just chatted or maybe listened to the 8-track.
Yeah, and you probably, without realizing it, spent more time in the car. And I suppose you become more reflective and understanding of that if you've lost them or if they've gone. So, it was. I found it quite tricky at times, I have to say.
So what was the first car then? The very, very first car when you got, bang, your own car and you're off and running.
It was a Mini. You had a 2CV, did you? I had a Mini.
My 2CV was my second car. The first one was a Beetle. So yours was a Mini. What? Which one?
Because my mother raced Mini. So my mother Her first husband was a handy mini driver, and the two of them, Southwest based, wanted to go racing, and they met this very clever guy who'd come over from Eastern Europe called Jan O'Dor.
Do you know the story of Jan?
Yeah, well, there you go. My mother was involved in all of that in the late 50s. So,
well, you know, my dad's sister is Anne, who's married to Jan.
You're joking.
No. Yeah, well, Jan's my uncle.
Well, she would know she'd ask her about Angela Wilding, because that was my mother's name at the time. And that was, so they used to race with Jan.
Wow.
And so for me, she always used to talk about these minis, and there were some pictures of her racing a mini and Ralph, her then husband, racing a mini. So I was just fixated on having a mini. Had to be a mini.
Yeah.
And actually, like you, looking back, it's just a total statistic fluke that I didn't kill myself. Because I just flung it around, basically missing trees with not an awful lot of skill. Can we stop here for a minute? We've got to discuss one thing, which is one of the greatest single things that's ever happened on the internet. And I've never spoken to you in person about it. Oh, we might have done it at Goodwood once.
Yeah, go on.
You, the dry cleaners and piston heads, is my favourite internet. That is.
I don't know this story.
Oh Jesus.
It went around the globe, didn't it? You know, Jalopnik picked up on it.
It was amazing.
A classic.
Over to you, Mr. Plato.
Oh, do you know what? Back in the, I mean, this is what, maybe 10 odd years ago, maybe more, Chris, I reckon.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the PR people that was looking after me got in contact and said, mate, have you seen this thread on Piston Heads? And I'm like, no. So I logged on, and basically the opening thread was some bloke had given me a right good grilling and basically painted a load of lies and said that I was rude to him at the dry, I'd parked badly at the dry cleaners and yada, yada, yada. Anyway, I just watched this thread develop, and after about 10 pages, I thought, I need to come in and just correct the record. Well, I corrected it in such a way, it was like a lesson to this weirdo. And it just went global. And literally, it was starting to rain. I popped out the dry cleaners, and he just appeared from nowhere, a bit like Mr. Ben, and just started jabbering at me. And I was, you know, kind, and I shook his hand, but he wouldn't let go of my hand. And I had to ask him. I said, mate, can I have my hand back? But of course, all this stuff, he didn't paint the true picture. So when I put the record straight, I mean, I did feel sorry for him. After about 80-odd pages, I did have to then go back on and go, look guys, we've had our fun. Leave him alone. But the funny thing, which you won't be aware of, Chris, I bumped into him maybe 5 years afterwards. And I'd gone into Halfords in Oxford to get a battery, and there he was behind the till.
Oh no!
Yeah,
really?
Yeah. And I and what's more is I'd stored this still image of him on his profile in the back of my mind somewhere, and I'm paying for this battery, and he's kind of doing that funny look again. I'm looking at him going, I know this guy. And all of a sudden, it came back to me before the credit card transaction was complete, and I just said, are you sorry? And he went, oh my God. Went into some wibble moment. But yeah, it was a funny, funny, poor sod.
No, but you don't need to feel sorry for him, because what you did do is you corrected something that goes on online that for people that are in the public eye can be very, very difficult to deal with, which is this idea that someone misrepresents a meeting or an interaction. And I find it very frustrating, because I do, even though I am small and rude, I do pride myself on always trying to be polite to people.
Yeah.
And if anyone says to me, you were rude to me, I know they're lying. Because if someone comes up to me and says, hello, I will always look them straight in the face, and I'll engage in the conversation. And if I want it to end, I'll politely end it. But I won't say, I need this to end, I'll just move on.
Yeah.
But that guy made the mistake of going on there, and you know the thread was it Jason Plato a knob or something? I mean, he didn't use his words, did he?
It was a better word than that,
was it? Well, and he just went. And if you hadn't corrected it,
oh, it would have stayed out there.
Everyone on that thread would have thought you were a nasty person, and that's not fair. Your correction happens to be, and I'm not brand nosing here, of the highest quality. Because what he's being very modest about, Mr. Plato, is that he just, in bullet points, listed how not to come across as a weirdo when you meet someone. And it just got funnier and funnier. There were four or five points, one of which was engage eye contact, release hand after 15 seconds. It was just how not to come across as a nut job. But if you hadn't in, you know, kind of interjected there, everyone would have assumed you were a knob. And it's, yeah. I don't care who you are. I've got pretty thick skin. But occasionally someone will send me a link saying, have you read this? And I'll go, where's that come from? I got sent one about a year ago where some bloke on, I think it was Piston Heads, had said that I'd tried to drive off a pavement and run him over. I've done lots of silly things in my life, but I'd remember if I'd tried to run someone over, and I really hadn't. But then you think, should I go on there and say, hello, it's me. I didn't try and run anyone over, but that's so absurd that you're almost protesting too much. But I'm so glad you did it. And it would, as you say, it went on and on and on.
I mean, it was funny, wasn't it? And there was this weird thing, which I didn't know about at the time. Apparently, I had to prove my authenticity.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
Authenticity, but by doing a thing which is called the custard test. I'm like, what the?
What's a custard test?
That is the best thing. So
is it broadcastable?
The custard test. Yeah. Go on, Chris. Tell them what it is.
So my understanding of the custard test is this: that forum, or most forums, being utterly faceless, are full of people that are just lying, or, you know, aren't the people they say they are. Yeah. And in that particular context, probably don't own the cars they say they own.
Yeah.
So there was this young lad who was on a forum. I think I know him as well. And after a bit, someone asked him what cars he had. And he said, I've got this and this and this. And someone just called BS, said, no, there's no way you own those cars. You're just a fantasist. You're just another commenter who doesn't own those cars. I'm calling you out. And he went, well, I do. And someone randomly said, right, go to your garage now and take a photo of a tin of bird's custard powder on your Pagani Zonda or something like that. And 5 minutes later, this bloke had a photo of bird's custard posted on his Zonda on the forum. And from then on, to prove that you were who you were, it was called the custard test.
Oh, so I love that.
And that's why. So even now, if someone calls you out, it's a custard test and you have to go buy. The big problem is, if you can't get the custard powder, then you're a
liar.
Stuffed. Yeah.
Imagine being in a situation where you've got the Pagani's under, but you can't get the custard to prove it.
Well, do you know what? I didn't know if we had custard, but I eventually found some at Top Cupboard. And as I was pulling it out, I spilt the lot all over me. And I took the picture, and literally I'm covered in dust and powder, which then caused more offence because people assumed other things.
Yeah.
Which I then had to correct that record.
I love the idea that Plato's the Bavarian Bolivian custard powder. It's absolutely brilliant. But no, I think what's interesting about that episode is that I don't care about public image. I don't care about any of that. You don't either, I know, neither of you two. But what that did for you showed that such a positive impact. People would have left that thread thinking, he's a decent human being, he's funny, he can take the piss out of himself. You can't buy that. That's the great thing about forums. We all whinge about the fact that we can't control what people are saying about us. But in that, if you flip it on its head, that episode for you was awesome, because there's the biggest forum in the UK that suddenly think, Christ, Plato can laugh at himself and he's a good lad. So you couldn't have bought that, which was interesting, the way you managed to flip it on its head. Anyway, it was enough of being nice about you. That was,
yes, I was going to say,
that was highly amusing.
I can't believe I've never heard that story before.
I'm amazed you haven't.
So, Chris, what's in the garage at the minute? Two and four?
I've got... So two is SP1,
right.
Which I love. I haven't been out on the bikes for a while. I've got an Anniversario 1199 Panigale. I've got that new Panigale R, which is just, they're just too fast, really. I don't know what you do with them. And I'm not a very good rider. I'm all right, but they're good fun. I just look at them, really. I had a Tuono. That's the best bike I've ever owned, that Aprilia Tuono.
Yeah.
But it got run over by a bin lorry and got written off, so I've got to get another one of them. But the bin man left a note under the steering column saying, I did this and I got the money off the insurance. What a nice man. So I had some beer sent to him because he didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
He could have just left my bike on the floor. Cars, I've just bought an R129 SL, a 500, done about 50,000 miles. The old TR's having it serviced, so that'll need a mortgage to pay for that. And then what else have I got? Old M5 Touring. Dude, I've got so many old cars. I've just bought, I can't say what it is now, but let's just say I reckon I've bought the worst Ferrari in the UK. And I look forward to revealing that to people over the next couple of weeks, because I'm going to have to do that.
Would it be a Mondial?
It might not be unadjacent to a Mondial. But I just love, I'm fascinated by the quirky, and I've got many issues with modern car media and the directions which it's gone. I'm well publicised, you know, laughing at some of the sort of influencer thing. But the bit that I don't get is that everyone's obsessed with brand new supercars, because I just don't get them. I never, I like making films about them and describing them and driving them. But it, for myself, they're just not interesting. I like quirky, silly stuff. I really do. Look, I'm always buying stuff I shouldn't buy. I've got a garage, I've got a shed full of old French rubbish, 205s and AXs and stuff like that that I really love.
Oh, have you got 205 GTI? Please say yes.
No, I've got two XSs, because in the day, I could never afford to insure a GTI because I was a bit younger.
I'd forgotten about the XS.
Best car. So I've got two of them, and I've got two rallies, which is the really nice French one that I adore. So I've got those. I've got the oldest. It's sawned at the moment. We've got the oldest registered AXGT in the country. I know that.
Have you?
Yeah, that's about to have a bit of a resto on it. I've got another two of those lying around as well. All I do is buy stuff that I used to read about when I was reading car magazines in the early 90s. And I'm obsessed with it. So I've got, you know, E34 M5, E28 M5, E30 M3. I just buy all the stuff that used to be in the performance car of the year, 1992. That's my era.
And they're great drives, aren't they?
They are. And they show up what's wrong with modern cars. But rather than whinge about the way a modern car feels now, I just accept what modern cars can do. They're incredibly impressive. I was skidding about in the new M5 CS last week. And, it, you know, this is a car that they claim's got 635 horsepower. It's clearly got about 700. I mean, it's laying 11s when you go fourth to fifth in the dry. The modern performance cars are absurd.
Do you think our listeners will understand what laying 11s is?
I hope so. It means two lines of rubber coming off the back tyres. I mean, anything else. And I, as an object to impress you, you know, if I'd been given that car to road test when I first started, I'd have just been mind blown by it. But now it just feels so out of touch with the way the roads work and what you can actually do on the road. Doesn't mean I won't celebrate it, but you do scratch your head and go, what am I going to do with this? And the thing is quite numb. You've kind of got to be going so fast for it to reveal what it can do. And so increasingly, I like cars that deliver something at low speed. The modern stuff at the moment I find problematic. I just don't.
Hey, here's a question for you, Chris. Yeah. Modern stuff, electric. Where do you sit with that?
Oh, God. So we've just been in some electric cars this week. So, we were doing some towing with electric cars. I don't have a huge problem with electric cars. I can understand that the world needs to change, that it's not reasonable to carry on burning fossil fuels the way we are, the way the population's growing, and the way that people want to be personally mobile. That just isn't a solution for the future. Synthetic fuels might come along, hydrogen might work, I don't know. But right now, it has to change.
Yeah.
And if that means that at the moment electricity is what people think we should be doing, I happen to not agree it's the one-stop solution that people are saying it is. But if that's the way it's going, we have to kind of engage with it. But the moment a motor car isn't infinitely flexible to the person that's using it, it's no longer of any use. That's my view. So the moment it doesn't bend to your every need, the moment that it inserts itself as a problem in your day, I'm not interested in it. I just go and take a cab or I jump on a train.
Yeah.
And that's the bit that gets me. And that's about infrastructure, not about the vehicles themselves. The vehicles themselves were already there. The latest Teslas have got an adequate range. And like anything in life, the way that people judge range is so skewed. The way you judge range is on the bladder of the person that's got the weakest bladder in the car. That's the way you judge range. So we're already at the place where electric cars have got enough range. And in fact, the general thinking is that range will now go down.
Why?
Well, because they think there'll be enough infrastructure to mean that you won't need such big batteries, therefore, and that's the most wasteful part of the process of making them, which is a bit terrifying going forward. It's also making them much cheaper to make. So I was in an Audi, handily named e-tron GTRS, which is the Audi that's based on the Taycan.
Yeah.
And it is, by any yardstick, a brilliant motor vehicle. You know, it's just comfortable, it's quiet, it's fast, it's not fun in the way that we've discussed with Jason. But that, I think we have to accept the fact that those very interactive, dainty, lightweight cars are gone in terms of everyday driving.
But that ultimately is a problem here, isn't it? And that's ultimately what I think we're all saying. And it's funny, actually, Chris, that you say this, because I think it's an opinion which has been echoed by pretty much everybody on Fueling Around that we've spoken to recently, is that we all appreciate that they're very clever and they're undoubtedly the future, and not one of us can make a justified argument for the continuation of the burning of fossil fuels. However, they're just not fun and they're just not exciting.
Yeah.
I think that I don't think that the right noggins have been engaged in the electric car world yet. And I think too many of them are still engaged in the world of the piston engine because that's what they want to do. But when they can't do that anymore and they shunt their attention to the electric vehicle, we might be surprised. For example, why isn't there an electric car with a gearbox? You know, the most basic thing you need to do as a driver, if you like driving, is to be busy. Mm. So if you just stick a gearbox in, you've already got something to do. And you're more engaged in the process. Now, we converted a Triumph Spitfire to electricity 2 years ago for our film on Top Gear. And I had a half a Tesla motor in the back of a Spitfire, but I had four on the floor. And it made the whole thing so much more enjoyable. It was pointless because I had the same acceleration in every gear, but I felt like I was doing something. I really enjoyed it.
Here's a thought. I had this conversation with our joint mate, Johnny Smith, the other day, and that is, I reckon it's going to be harder for us to review cars when everything starts going electric, because they're all going to do the same thing.
Yeah.
And each one's not going to have a character. Do you think that's right?
I think you could end up in a situation where you've got a sort of proprietary technology, a base.
Yeah.
For the car that is the same. And if it's the same, then, you know, the only differences you're going to get are probably in calibration. You'll find that, you know, the Audi does something a bit differently to the Porsche, it's a bit like hi-fi in the 80s, you know, everything kind of had the same flashing lights and sounded the same, didn't it? Yeah. And yet everyone stand up and go, I'm a Technics man. And then you find out it's made in the same factory as the Sony.
Yeah.
So I think that's just something that's going to happen. It makes me sad. But what's going to happen then, Jason, is everyone's going to reminisce. And there's going to be a big industry in remembering how great the past was. Then they're going to roll out touring car drivers and journalists from the late 90s. They're going to go, this is what it was like. And we're going to bore them with our stories.
This was kind of what I was going to say, actually. You've actually painted a happier picture of it, Chris, I would suggest. Because I was going to say that, do you think that we are part of a dying breed in many ways in terms of being of that age where we have that emotional relationship with motor vehicles that will perhaps never be continued with our children because they will never actually see the character in cars anymore and therefore never have that attachment?
Yeah, I think I think it's more sinister than that. I think the motor vehicle, if you've got children of a certain age, is presented at school as being an evil.
Yes.
There's no celebration of the fact that it's, you know, linked communities, that it's been an incredibly positive thing for the human race. All people discuss is its polluting qualities, and they're seen as evil. And so actually, you know, for a 15-year-old to be a car enthusiast now is they are anomalous within their group of friends.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're quite right. But that doesn't mean we can't carry on celebrating it. It does mean, though, that people that spend, you know, a couple of million quid, if they've got lots of money and spend 2 million quid on a very rare Ferrari, what's the value of that in 20 years' time if there's no one coming through that also values that as an object? Now, if you spend 2 million quid on a significant painting, in 10 years' time, 20 years' time, there will still be people, there'll be new generations of people that are recently enriched or have money that like art. I'm not sure about the motor car.
I think you might be right, Chris.
Yeah, but equally, that's not going to stop me enjoying my passion and hoping that events like Goodwood would carry on. I think there will increasingly be places to go and enjoy and indulge your passion for cars that will be great fun. I'm not so worried about the electric revolution in terms of the cars. It's the infrastructure. Yeah. That's the bit. I had a fascinating chat with a guy from the National Grid last year for Top Gear. It's on YouTube somewhere. Really good guy. Because he turned up and I was really worried because there's an electric car faction. And they are. They're bloody fundamentalists on Twitter. You know, if you're known to be like myself and Mr. Plato, they'll come after you because they just view you as the pariah. And I'm not. You know, I'm willing to accept alternative futures. But what I won't do is just buy into one single piece of technology, because everything that I've read about history tells me that if you buy into one thing, that tends to be disappointing. Yeah. It's never the right solution. But this guy turned up. And he turned up in an Elise with a piston head sticker in the back of it. And I just immediately thought, oh, he's a human being. And he went on to talk about the electric future in such a sensible way that he almost allayed most of my fears. It didn't stir my passion. But what he basically said was, we're doing all we can to provide enough electricity. There will be enough power to do this electric thing over the next 50 years. But the infrastructure is not our problem. That's kind of down to private companies. And that's the bit that worries you.
Yeah.
Because without being able to charge the bloody things, I had a mate of mine yesterday, he's a doctor, who was, you know, one of my old buddies, who was going from Somerset back up to Leicestershire. And he's phoning me from some services going, oh, I'm just sitting here for an hour charging my car and I can't be arsed with it. I don't want to, I don't want to do this.
That's the problem, isn't it?
But I think there's a lot of fun to be had with people converting old cars to electric. Mm. That could be a laugh. I think like anything, you can react to your something that's very important to your life changing in a way that worries you. You can either rage against it and become all curmudgeonly and defensive, or you can just go, I'm going to embrace it and I'm going to see where it goes and I'm going to carry on having the most fun I can whilst it lasts. I buy into the latter attitude. Mm, mm.
What is your two-car fantasy garage? There's no price limit on this. We know one thing that certainly won't be in there, but what would you say would be your two-car fantasy?
Look, this change. I get asked this a bit. It changes on a daily basis. If you're like me, you wake up every day and then you work out what day it is because you don't normally know. And I don't really have a strategic view of anything, but that question changes every day for me. So today, for example, I've already thought about it because I do.
Yeah.
I won 1974 3-litre RS Porsche, which is the ugly one that came after the 73 RS, which is obviously the doyen of all Porsche RS models. Yeah. But the 74 with the big bumpers is the car to drive. It's an amazing vehicle. And it's well over £1 million, so I couldn't afford one of those. But it's just a gorgeous car. And I just like an estate car. I don't like SUVs much. I like an estate car. So right now, what I'd like is a V10, M5, whatever it was, E61, I presume it was, the estate car. That would do me fine. So I'd go Porsche RS and a wagon.
Great choice.
That's today. But tomorrow it'll be different.
So here's a quickie for you. Like me, Chris, we're lucky. We've driven some amazing cars, both on the road and also on road tests, but also at events like Goodwood. If you could choose one, any one, and you could drive it from A to B on the road with some music, A, what car would it be? Where would it be in the world? And what would you listen to?
I had a race in a Lister Costin coupe a few years ago at Goodwood.
Yeah.
And bloody Reed Speed got overtaken on the last... He got overtaken on the last lap. Bless it being Anthony, that it was just a fantastic piece of theatre.
Yes.
That car, I just love that car. The Lister Costin Coupe, there's only one.
Yeah.
You can't hear yourself thinking it, so I'd have to wear ear pods. And I've got several songs that I listen to at different times in the car that people find perplexing. But I suppose there's one that consistently, if I play it, it always improves my mood. And you'll laugh at me, but I think Van Halen's Jump is a song that just, whenever I hear it, I just smile and I just see massive mullets, tight leather trousers, and just leather excess, and just good times. So that would be it. It's a weird combination, but that would be it.
And where in the world?
Oh, I'd be on that crazy bit of road that goes between Draguignan in the south of France, so down near the Gorge du Verdon in Provence. There's a road that goes from Draguignan up to the A8, which is the famous route Napoleon.
Yeah.
That is the finest piece of tarmac. I don't even know what it's taking. It's a D road.
Yeah.
But you, by the time you get to the end of it, you're a frothing mentalist. It's so it makes the Nürburgring look like the M25. It's just an unbelievable bit road. And of course, you can stop off, and there's people cooking with truffles, and French people ignoring you, and it's just perfect. I love it. So before we knock off, I have to say one thing about Mr. Plato here. So it's weird for me to even come on something like this in front of Jason, because he was the preeminent driver in the series that I love most for many, many years. And I just, you know, I remember when I first met him, I was completely starstruck because he was obviously just being chatty and at the bar as ever. But I remember the first time I saw him, and it was a moment that stuck with me. I was work experience for Autocar, and it was about 1996, I think it was. We're at Silverstone. And, you know, he was just exploding on the scene at that point. And he turned up to do some driving for the Autocar handling day. And I was basically like the ashtray for the day, or just the thing they kicked, just to get out of the way. And he arrived on a Ducati to drive these cars. He heard the thing from about a mile away. And he just arrived on a Ducati, where it would have been like a beautiful 916 or something, anyway it was.
That's exactly what it was, yeah.
He got off it and then just skidded these cars about, laughed at everyone and then just left. And I just thought, Christ, I want his job. and it stuck with me. And he was a good lad. And he wasn't up himself. He just laughed and had a good laugh. And honestly, mate, it totally struck me that I will never, ever forget seeing you arrive on that bike. And I just thought, that's, and that, I suppose, if ever I want to arrive on the scene, I'd like to look like that. And I've never managed it once.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say.
I appreciate the journey. It's been mega. And it's lovely to speak to you both as well.
And you too, mate. And you too.
Likewise, Chris. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. And we've taken up plenty of your time. Jason, I think you need to take us out.
Well, that's about it for this episode of Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or your home insurance. Dave, as always, thanks. But a special thanks to our special guest this week, the one and only Mr. Chris Monkey Harris. Thanks, buddy.
Cheers, boys. Stay well.
No, it's been great. Don't forget you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plato or at David Vitti. And if you liked what you heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button and share the podcast on all your socials.
Thanks for listening and we'll see you next time. Ta-da!